Look, say what you want about the whole Middle Eastern skirmish. It's been going on forever. And it, in all likelihood, will be going on forever. But I listened to Dave Smith, who's, he's a self-proclaimed and is a, he's a Jew. He's a Jewish guy. He's very Jewish, but he's not, I don't know how practicing he is, but he's Jewish. But he when I'm listening to him on his podcast, he's talking about the Israel-Hamas skirmish like the guy, like a guy dating a girl who just lost her job and it was her fault. But she's really trying to sell the narrative that the people she worked with set her up, you know? You know what I mean? Like, you ever have that situation where, like, your lady's kind of a little into the drama, you know? Or, like, she just had a bad experience at a restaurant or something, you know? She felt like the server kind of was slighting her or something, you know? But deep down, you know it was her fault, like, because you watched her the whole time be rude to the server. Or just be kind of short or condescending or, you know. But she's like, this place is terrible. This place is terrible. You know, these people are so rude. But you just, the whole time, you're just thinking, yeah, okay. But anyway, what's up, people? I got a lot going on. I got a lot to share with you. There's a lot of shit going on. Lots of good things going on. First, I'd like to start out with a shout out to backup quarterback Jake Browning of the Cincinnati Bengals. I was thinking I was without a team this year. And I thought, you know what? I'll be kind of a de facto kind of surrogate fan for some new endeavor, right? So I picked the Jets and then Because Aaron Rodgers, and then four snaps in, he's yesterday's news. So, okay, all right, well, man, you know, the Lions are looking really good. And, gosh, maybe they're like the underdog, the dark horse, you know. And then they lost to the Packers, which isn't, it turns out the Packers are kind of, they're coming together, but I do like the Lions, but now I'm like, what is going on? Like, so when Joe Burrow went out for the season with a wrist injury, cue the backup Jake Browning from Folsom, California, by way of, well, from University of Washington, by way of Folsom, California, Pac-12 quarterback, local boy, Folsom, California, took the 5-6 Bengals to was it overtime victory? Did they beat those motherfuckers in a, the Jags. They beat the Jags last Monday night in overtime. And, shit, the dude throws for 354 yards. Now, they're beating up on the Colts. I mean, now say what, okay, so the Colts are, that's a decent team, particularly with their, I mean, they're all playing, everybody's playing a backup. Like, that's the problem with the NFL this year, if you want to call it that, all right? So they're putting this strange product out on the field that nobody seems to kind of, I don't know. Brady's been kind of a critic, you know. It probably wasn't forced out of him, but he did comment on it. I kind of noticed it too. Like, when I was watching the Thursday night game, the Patriots and the Steelers, I'm thinking, oh, the Steelers are just going to run roughshod of these guys, particularly in Pittsburgh. So they got both their backups in. So it's Mitchell Trubisky's under center for the Steelers in Pittsburgh, And you got Bailey Zappi, who I'm thinking, okay, finally they get this guy. Zappi, he throws for like 196 in the first half, three TDs. Second half, just farted and fell, nothing. So it was like 21-10 going into the second half, third quarter. And these guys just can't get out of neither team could get out of their own way. Final score 21-18. Patriots didn't do shit in the second half. They just barely held off a second-rate, lukewarm Steeler team. But it's all these backups, you know? So it's like Jake Browning for the Bengals, who are now, let's see, I believe they're, are they six? No, what are they, 7-6 now? So they got a legit shot. Like, they're not out of the conversation quite yet. I mean, the Bengals are still a viable threat. So that might be, I don't know. I've kind of been semi-interested in the Bengals. Well, since Joe Burrow took him to the Super Bowl, I'm like, that guy's kind of legit, I guess. But it's a rough year. It's a weird year. The product could be better. Getting back to the Patriots and Steelers, like Bailey Zappi, who I kept saying, like, this guy's got the single season passing yardage record in the NCAA at 5967 with Western Kentucky. I mean, there's nothing to sneeze. This guy's legit, but when I looked at him, I mean, he looks like the guy. And I want to get behind this guy. I'm a Patriots fan, you know? And I want to be a Zappi fan, but he looks like, and he gives off that same vibe, and I might be way off, but he looks like he gives off the same kind of vibe as that dude who Burt Reynolds made famous after Marky Mark and Boogie Nights. You know, the second dude that became a porn star who was kind of an asshole. Yeah. And I'm like, but he's talented. I don't know. You gotta let the shit kind of simmer a little, right? I don't know. He just looks young and kind of brash. I don't know. Fuck it. I don't know. The second half was a snooze fest. Just wasn't much of a product. I don't know. So I changed that. Once that was over, I watched an interesting show the other night. It was a Tom Wolfe kind of documentary. And for those of you that don't know, Tom Wolfe is kind of one of the new he is kind of one of the founders of the new journalism back in the 60s. And but he's also kind of an interesting character himself. But he started this, the story goes that he had to go out, he got sent by a magazine, I think it was Esquire, out to a speedway to cover a race, like a stock car race of some sort. And he's just out of his element. He's kind of a southern gentleman from Virginia who always wore like these three-piece suits, complete with vest, hat. He looked kind of like, almost like a pimp, really. But he's this little white dude with an almost kind of drawl, like the beginnings of a drawl in his accent. But he didn't know anything about cars. He didn't know anything about sports, I don't think, of any sort. And he went out there to cover this. And he took several, lots of footage, lots of pictures, lots of captions, but he had nothing to go off of material wise to write. He didn't have a perspective. He didn't know the sport. He didn't know anything about cars. So he just kind of created these sentences. It's like onomatopoeia. Onomatopoeia. It's like a word that sounds like what it is, like vroom, you know, like clang, clang, stuff like that. So he started making up these words that describe the sounds of these cars at this race. And it just kind of it was the beginning of this kind of new journalism, which ushered in a lot of these guys like Hunter S. Thompson and Norman Mailer and Gay Talese. And and he was just kind of a gun for hire, really. He started out as a reporter, as a, you know, really just a journalist. And he worked for like the New York Telegraph or something like that, or the Examiner, not the big ones, but like a, you know, I mean, big city paper, but not the big, you know, not the Post or the Times, but he's so he's this kind of Southern gentleman, wears this three-piece suit, usually white, yeah, with white shoes, white hat, but he also he wrote the book Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, which that's one of my top five probably, about Ken Kesey and the Merry Pranksters and the whole advent of kind of acid and the Grateful Dead and hippies. And the distinction that, say, now keep in mind, this guy rode with them on the bus, on the Merry Prankster bus, dressed like a Southern gentleman, right? And as odd as that sounds and as odd as that seems, and as kind of as out of his element as he probably was, it was the best depiction of the times going, really. And that's what kind of distinguished him. So he became kind of this cultural figure. And in my opinion, I've read, of course, the Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test. He did Bonfire of the Vanities, which they made a movie about. It was kind of a morality tale in New York about a high-powered, I think, financier, if I remember right. And then a reporter that covers kind of this, he gets entangled in this kind of controversial entanglement with some street thugs. And, it's fiction for one. And he primarily wrote nonfiction. So this was his first endeavor into fiction, but he was such an arbiter of like the times that, or the pulse of the city at the time. Oddly enough, the Southern gentleman dressed like a pimp was such a social kind of what's the best word? He was a kind of an enfant terrible, right? Like he was kind of like a Christopher Hitchens back in the day, right? Where he would like, he's very contrarian. Like, shout out to the contrarians. So this guy was like, he wrote an attack piece on the New Yorker. He lived in New York and wrote kind of an attack piece on like the Sacred Cow magazine that all the liberals really, really, really get behind in the New Yorker, which is a kind of an elitist rag anyway. But it was so... it was so vehemently just hated by the establishment, because he was very anti-establishment, so if you haven't gathered that by now. But so like the powers that be, like, because there's always those circles, everybody's got a circle, the writers have circles, you know, the popular, you know, circle, the cliques and stuff like that. And I don't think he was ever quite He was really more commenting on those circles than he was in the circles. But those circles now run and get behind things like the New Yorker. And they were so appalled by this piece. They fucking got J.D. Salinger, the most reclusive writer in the history of everything, aside from like Thomas Pynchon, to write like a retort to his New Yorker piece. Like they were so mad and so desperate to kind of respond to this hit piece that they got J.D. Salinger, like the guy that wrote Catcher in the Rye, like the guy that hasn't been like seen in public in like 50 years, right? So bizarre, but it keeps you honest though, you know, because those people get smug, They get complacent. We all do. In all our little circles, we get smug and complacent, right? But he also wrote, like, this other piece about, it's called Radical Chic, about when Leonard Bernstein and his wife hosted a party for the Black Panthers. Yeah. Where they, and he made it out like it was kind of a virtue signal that Leonard Bernstein, they're raising money for this activist group, the Black Panthers, who were kind of a, well, on the violent side. And, but they were, that was their way of promoting civil rights. And so the piece was seen as kind of this, like the Bernsteins, Leonard and his wife were kind of virtue signaling. Like, because it'd be like the, like Leonard Bernstein would be like the last person you would think would be hanging out with the Black Panthers. But here they are in his, you know, his bourgeois Manhattan apartment, hanging out and, you know, having cocktails and stuff. So he was definitely a problem child for the establishment. But I love shit like that. That cracks me up. I love that shit. You know, it's like, again, speaking of Christopher Hitchens, like, he was the same way. Like, Christopher Hitchens was very, very contrarian. So much so that he supported the Iraq War. He made a lot of enemies. And these guys didn't care, but they made a lot of enemies. But they just didn't give a fuck. They didn't give a fuck. Christopher Hitchens tell you to your face, you know, that, you know, Muslims are idiots. That Christianity is a joke, you know. That the Bible, you know, only really covers about 200 square miles of one patch of land in all the Middle East, where there was Chinese scholars that have, you know, been reading and writing for centuries, who could have dispelled any notion of what the Bible purported. But those that in the small region that the Bible takes place in didn't read or write. I mean, he would fuck you up in a debate all the time. Because he knew everything about everything. Like, he could just quote. It's just fascinating stuff. But, you know, he knew the Bible. He knew the Quran. He knew all that, you know, Hinduism. With him, you don't bring a knife to a gunfight, right? He'll fuck you up. But Hitchens, one of his more popular articles that he wrote for Esquire as well, I believe, was Why Women Aren't Funny, which is like, damn, bro, going hard. But what that's kind of a clickbaity headline, because what, in essence, he was talking about was the mere fact that the social stratagem of men versus women. See, men have to create a persona and a personality and have wit, have a sense of humor, and a strong, you have to bring your A game to meet women. Women respond to funny. Women respond to personality. If you don't got that, you don't got shit. Although, I mean, unless you got a big old hog, you know, or something, I don't know. But that, you know, that only lasts so long. But, you know, personality goes a long way, like Samuel L. Jackson said in Pulp Fiction. And so the article, the bent of the article was that women don't have to be funny. There are funny, now he says, there are women that do stand up comedy, and they are funny, but they don't have to be. Like, and the ones that do practice and are, you know, seasonably strong female stand-up comedians definitely take a page from the men's book, right? So he cited examples like Roseanne Barr being kind of butchy, being kind of dykey, being kind of manly. One of the ones I always thought was, I mean, the funniest, one of the funniest women I ever noticed early on back in the 80s was Ellen DeGeneres. She's super funny, but she's a dyke. And that doesn't take away from anything, but I don't know. She just, in my opinion, she had her own style as well. Like, it was a timing thing. With her, it was timing. But you could tell she was like, you're like, oh, she's a, She's definitely a lesbian. I don't know how people didn't pick that up earlier, but they're taking, well, according to Christopher Hitchens, they were taking pages out of the men's book too. They had to compete with the men on their level. You know, they couldn't bring, I don't know, they couldn't just, it just, the women, they just, it's a man, it's a, unfortunately, it's a man's world. It was started by men, and it was men's rules, and they had to break in, and they had to use the men's rules against them to find any success. But the long and the short of it is that they don't have to be funny, so they don't have to work that muscle. And I, you know, I've even heard that from feminists like Camille Paglia say, like, you know, the reason that there's more men geniuses is because they're driven to these depths of obsession, obsessive behavior, and compulsion to create and innovate and be inventors and industrialists and entrepreneurs, probably with a secret, deep kind of need to impress women. But the women don't have to do that. The women just say, all right, dinner's on, boys, and just ring a little triangle and watch them come, right? So, but anyway, moving on. So you're probably wondering why I called you all here, right? So this is a good one. So I told, you know, of course, I was talking about going camping. And I had booked Mount Diablo, and everything was going brilliantly Saturday. I knocked out a couple of jobs. I had to go up to Grass Valley in Auburn, and then I got done there, stopped by the house, grabbed a couple of things, and then I was on the road to meet the boys, the fellas, because my son's bringing Jesse and Jesse, the Jessies, Jesse Squared. And he was meeting me in Manteca, where we'd round up just like snacks and shit. We'll grab a big bag of chicken sandwiches and some waters, and then we roll. Then we head for the East Bay. Then we get on 680. And then we get on Diablo Road, and we start climbing, and we're climbing, and we're climbing, and we're climbing, and we're climbing. And we're going up through these neighborhoods, and it's kind of weird, and it's, you know, dark. And then about 3 miles from the campground, there's a big gate, a big locked gate. Wah, wah. And I'm like, what the fuck is this? So I booked the place, and we called. Well, of course, now it's like 7 o'clock. It's 7 p.m. or thereabouts. And no, nobody's at the Mount Diablo campground office at 7 p.m. on a Saturday. I know. Odd, huh? But so I'm like, well, this doesn't bode well. And I'm thinking to myself, well, what the fuck are we going to do now? So I go, well, so the back of my head, I'm just kind of jogging my memory. So we're like a stone's throw from like my sister's or my ex-in-laws. I said, well, should we call my sister? Maybe we'll camp in her backyard. Like, what do you guys think? You know, so my son's kind of scrambling, and then I'm thinking, He goes, okay, what about Grammys? You know, we can just kind of throw the tent up out back there. I go, wait a minute. I go, first of all, we're not getting in. First of all, I didn't know you could close a mountain. I didn't know they, you know, a mountain has hours, but they closed it down. So we start heading back down, and I'm like, what about the Altamont? And of course, my son doesn't even know he doesn't even realize we'd gone over the Altamont to get where we're at, nor do the Jessies, I don't think. And I'm thinking, you know, the Altamont, I've been over that hump, that pass so many times. there is a little kind of a like a little outcropping of dirt there that kind of looks out over the hills of the Altamont Pass, you know. And you look down on the freeway, you look out, you can look down and you can see Tracy on one side, you can see parts of Livermore on the other. Technically, it was still in Livermore, but we're heading for Altamont. We're heading for the Altamont. What's at the Altamont? Nothing. Like, literally. Like, sometimes history's lost on the youth, right? Like, these guys don't even realize, like, the Altamont Expressway had one of the gnarliest concerts ever, where the Rolling Stones set up, like, they wanted to set up, like, the Woodstock of the West. So they went out to the Altamont Expressway. And it was a free concert, and that's where they had the Hell's Angels as their security, and they stabbed this kid up front, like right up front, like while Mick Jagger was singing, and which is a gnarly affair. But that's what that's the Altamont, right? So I go, okay, so is that what we're gonna do, or what do you think? And then I thought, hold on. So we were going to meet at the Great Wolf Lodge. We ended up meeting down the block from the Great Wolf Lodge in Manteca. The Great Wolf Lodge is like this big, if you're not aware, it's like this gigantic hotel with like an outdoor theme indoors, right? So there's like outdoor scenarios and scenes, and indoors like there's water slides and just kind of gimmicky stuff going on indoors. Makes you think like you're roughing it outdoors. And I thought, well, maybe they got a room, you know, if for some reason maybe the Altamont doesn't work out or wherever, let's get a room, you know, we'll suck it up, we'll be suburbanized failures, right? But I go, so I had my boy look it up, and he said there's one room left. I go, so ask the Jessies. So the Jessies, they're sitting in back. I go, ask the Jessies. And I go, what do you guys think? What do you think? Great Wolf Lodge or Altamont? And I hear them both chime in. Altamont. I'm like, fuck yeah, fucking Jessies. Yes, Jessies. Let's fucking go. So they're like, fucking, they're like, in for a penny, in for a pound. Let's get weird, man. This is strange. Like, what's gonna be up there? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Just typically it's like like I was saying, it's like an outcropping of land that juts out over the bluffs of the Altamont Expressway there. And then some like big rigs park there, like truckers, like Walmart people and Amazon people that are just, I don't know, looking to snooze. And so we're tooling through the East Bay. We get up to the Altamont, we pull in, and there is in fact a big rig kind of wedged in there. Look like there's one or two other car, like just cars, random cars, randos. And it's kind of a place to pull over and kind of snooze for a bit. So I get out and I'm looking around. By now it's like, it's, I don't know, 7:30, 8 o'clock, pitch black. I'm looking, there's like broken glass everywhere. There's even a fucking, I didn't tell the boys this, but there's a fucking hypodermic needle in the rubble and the rocks and shit. And if that got back to their moms, like I'd lose my father of the year status, right? So but I brushed it all, I scooped it all away with my shoes, and then we went to work, man. We put some mats down, some yoga mats, some foamy mats, threw the tent up, and those fuckers hopped in there, and they fucking turned that thing into like a fucking smoke machine. Just hanging out on the edge of the bluffs of the Altamont Expressway, just hotboxing that. It looked like it was on fire. That tent looked like it was on fire. I slept in the Subaru. So I kind of, it's a two-man tent. There's three dudes in there. So I climbed in the Subi, and I'd start eating chili mangoes and just kind of scouting things out, looking at the traffic, looking at the freeway, looking out over the bluffs, looking at the trucks coming in, just a random assortment of people. I mean, there's literally no facilities. There's no running water. There's no restrooms. There's no toilets. I mean, there's nothing. I mean, just the starker, the better. It's very David Cho, you know, like when he was hitchhiking from Mexico to the North Pole, you know, he just kind of randomly jump on a train and then they'd find some kind of blown out kind of warehouse, just kind of abandoned in Bakersfield or Fresno, and just kind of kick through all the debris, do a little bit of their own graffiti tagging, and then just sleep it out, just riding their thumb, you know? And so that's what we did. We David Cho'd it a little. It was like all kind of very William T. Volman, you know? Volman's kind of one of those weirdos that kind of goes and hangs out with the homeless, you know, sits in their tents with them. Even one of the drivers, I remember telling me he slept with the homeless just to see what it was like. I thought to myself, maybe that's what I'll tell. Because I'm basically waiting for a cop to show up and just blare us out with his headlights and just get out and, you know, tap on the window with his big giant flashlight, you know, that he cracks skulls with, right? And just be like, well, what are you boys up to? And I'm just running through these ideas in my head, what are we gonna tell him? Could I tell him, I brought the fellas out here just kind of live a night like a homeless person, just to see what it was like, to kind of empathize with first of all, I don't think a cop's gonna buy that. So I thought, well, what about? Because I'm looking out the windows of the Subaru, I'm looking into the night sky, and there's you can see the stars, you can see planes and things like that. I'm thinking this is kind of a good view too for UFOs. I'm thinking if I get a cop encounter, if I get a police encounter, I'll tell them we're amateur UFOologists and this is a really good spot. That's my staff in that tent there that looks like it's on fire. And I'm kind of their team leader, you know, although I don't know how that really worked because they would, I'm just kind of going through all this in my head. Are these guys even old enough to be, are they allowed to smoke weed? Am I a good parent? Am I not good? I mean, is this bad? Is this weird? But it's also kind of I'm fascinated. It's a little bit of all the above, I think, because I'm fascinated by the vulnerability of certain tents. This little shit two-man tent that I had, is the staple tent for homeless. Every homeless tent you've ever seen is this one. But you see these tents on sidewalks and stuff. Literally, I've seen them here in the Mather area, Rancho. Literally, not in clusters of other tents, 10 cities under overpasses and things like that, but by themselves, on a sidewalk. Where people are walking by. How vulnerable is that? You're just kicking it. You're just kicking it. Just sleeping in the tent. How? And this is kind of similar to that. I'm thinking, if I make it through this evening, I should probably dial it down a little. Right? what the fuck, man? You know, it kind of made me think of I don't know. Have you ever seen that movie, Down and Out in Beverly Hills, you know, it's kind of like this silly flip side of culture. First and foremost, it's just camping. Okay. Just keep that in mind. It's just camping. Okay. But at the same time, it's when Richard Dreyfuss went out and hung out with Nick Nolte, who was this homeless guy in Beverly Hills. Right. But he was also an ex screenwriter who was connected in Hollywood and knew people, but he wandered the alleyways of Beverly Hills eating out of garbage cans, and he had a dog, and the dog runs away, and he decides he's going to kill himself, so he jumps into Richard Dreyfuss's pool. So Richard Dreyfuss comes out and saves him, and now he's got this homeless guy, Nick Nolte, living with him, and Nick Nolte kind of walks him through how, you know, life as a homeless person, right? And then Richard Dreyfuss walks Nick Nolte through life as a fucking industrialist entrepreneur who started a coat hanger, company for hotel chains. Like, and so Richard Dreyfuss goes out and he spends the night with Nick Nolte out on the streets in homeless encampments. And he gets back the next day, and his wife, who's played by Bette Midler, he goes, "What have you done? Where have you gone? Where have you been? I've been worried sick. I've been calling the police." He's like Barb, or whatever her name was. I ate garbage last night. I ate garbage and I loved it, you know? So it's like this yuppie entrepreneur kind of guy that's kind of banging the maid, hates his wife, hates his life. Just having one of those moments, you know, where he's like redefining himself and all this shit. And it's fun. It's a good movie. It's hilarious, actually. But that's kind of like, I don't know, in a sense, it's what we were kind of poking at. It's like, if I survive this, I'm going to be like, yeah, we kind of slept in, on the Altamont, like on a, like near a freeway overpass. It's bizarre, you know? I don't know. It's not really bragging. It's that, it's not anything. It's just like, that's where we stayed, you know? Like, I've done it before. Shit. God, when was I mean, the number of times I've just thrown out a tent, you know, just randomly, like literally, like when I was in Ireland in the middle of a cow field. I mean, I got permission from the owner of the paddock, but it's like, you know, I'm driving home with the boys and I'm looking out across Manteca, you know, the barren fields of Tracy. And I'm going, how bold would it be to just throw a tent up right in the middle of that field? Like, come get me, you know? Like, it's just, the vulnerability is strange, you know? Like, back when I was, even before that, when I'd go up to, like, the Yuba River, and we would just kind of spontaneously just take off and go to sleep on a beach somewhere. There was no, like, looking for, or booking something, or contacting a campground, you know? The time I went up to Willow Creek with my buddy John, all we had was, I literally just had a blanket. Like, there was no tent, you know, just laying on a beach, right? Anybody could have come. And it was so cold. It was so cold. I wish somebody would have killed me, but it's just a strange vulnerability. But, you know, you try and be resourceful, I guess, right? Like, I mean, you could book something. I booked something that didn't pan out. I literally paid money to not go to Mount Diablo. And, but like when I was 18 or 19, coming back from the conference championships in track with Humboldt, we stopped off. We were coming back from Chico and we stopped off on 299 at Willow Creek where I had camped. This is before I'd come out there with just a blanket, I think. Yeah. And we were driving the team van and it had the Humboldt State seal, the university seal on the door. And the captain of our team, Scott Pesh, he's driving the van. And then there's like eight guys that look like all the mental defects from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest sitting, you know, riding in this van. It's got, you know, three or four rows, and we're pulling into the camp, to the Willow Creek campground there, to go down the river to go swimming. The guy, the park ranger at the booth, who took like 5 years of forestry classes to deal with us, we pull in and he's like, "Well, can I help you?" He goes, "Yeah, we're surveyors for the county of Humboldt, and we need to go do some," and you know, if you looked in there, all you'd have seen is about eight of the straggliest looking geeks you've ever seen. I guess we kind of look like surveyors, shirtless, emaciated surveyors, geologists of some sort, but but you know what? You just wing it, man. You just kind of slap something together, put it in, just throw it against the wall, see what sticks, you know? And we got in. They let us in. The park ranger, who had 5 years of forestry classes, waved us through. We didn't pay a dime. So, I don't know. Here I am, getting back to my roots, huh? But yeah, that's definitely some William T. Volman shit. And some down and out in Beverly Hills. And yeah, just this long history of just randomly setting up to just, I don't know, sleep somewhere out on the ground in the middle of nowhere. Some strange bullshit. But that's about what's up. You know, we had a good time. And I went back to work the next day. It was fine. It was great. I loved it. I really had it. And the boys, they had a great time. They're probably staring at you. There was, I did catch a moment where Jesse was looking at the other Jesse. He's going, "Arr. Okay. All right. is this what's happening? Okay. So, but we survived. And I'm naive and dumb enough to kind of just let myself enjoy the situation without overthinking it. So I think we pulled one off. We pulled a fast one, and that's the story I'm sticking with. And that's my story, and that's the end. And that's what I'm and that's what's up. Okay. So anyway, hope you all are doing well. Hope you're having a great week. Weather's here. It's Christmas time. All I want for Christmas is you. And that's it. That's about all I'm going to say on the subject of holidays. And I'll talk at you later. Arrivederci, babies.